Here and Now Anytime has a new episode every weekday afternoon. Make sure you don't miss anything by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or hereandnow.org. Just look for Here and Now Anytime. And thank you. Here's the show.
There will be some softening in labor market conditions, and I wish there were a completely painless way to restore price stability. There isn't.
The Fed forecasts more economic pain. It's Thursday, December 15th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, young people hoping an internship could give them a leg up in their career could be facing an even tougher climb as the economic outlook gets murkier. And why some people want the 2030 census to count American descendants of slavery. But first, interest rates are at a 15-year high after the Fed tacked on another 0.5% yesterday. Fed Chair Jerome Powell, whom we heard at the top, says the rate hike is necessary to clamp down on inflation. Their latest report shows prices in November were up about 7% from a year ago, and they want to get that down to about 2%. Inflation is slowing, but not fast enough for the Fed. And to get prices down, the Fed is willing to see people put out of work. That would be that softening in the labor market conditions we heard Powell refer to a moment ago. We often turn to MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi to help us make sense of big picture economic news. Here's his conversation today with Robin Young.
Well, the Fed's done it again, raising interest rates yesterday by another 0.5%, bringing them to a 15-year high. They were last at this level just before the 2008 financial crisis. That was caused by home loans made by unscrupulous lenders to people who couldn't afford them. Today's crisis is inflation, the cost of things. Fed Chair Jerome Powell said yesterday that raising rates further will help keep those prices under control.
Price stability is the responsibility of the Federal Reserve and serves as the bedrock of our economy. Without price stability, the economy doesn't work for anyone.
Let's bring in MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi to help us with this. Ali, hello.
Hello.
And some context first. Now, you've told us that high interest rates mean that businesses that borrow money to operate or people, you know, all of us paying off credit cards or loans, maybe paying a little more for that money that we're holding on to, you know, while we're borrowing it. But we also know some rates are fixed and some are variable. So explain that.
Yes. Yeah. So if you've got a fixed rate mortgage for 15 years or 5 years or 30 years, you're actually doing okay. Let's say you locked into your mortgage a year ago or 2 years ago at a low rate. Your biggest expense is covered. You might have an auto loan that's covered, you know, that's not moving. But if it's credit card rates or any kind of variable loan or the idea that you've been looking to spend on something. You want to buy a new car or you want to buy a dishwasher or washing machine or something like that or spend on a vacation. Now that new interest rate will be very high. So by design, increasing interest rates, as the Fed has been doing for months and months and months, is meant to say slow down your spending. It's supposed to have the effect of slowing down in spending. That reduces demand, that reduces prices, and that contains inflation. It's starting to work, but it generally takes a while for it to work.
Oh, well, that's okay. So you think it's starting to work. I want to hear more about that. But I also more about, you know, different people get hurt in different ways, as you've been saying. For instance, we know small businesses in particular borrow sometimes every month to make the payroll or to pay off the money that they borrowed the previous month, you know, to get through the month. And they often can't get those fixed interest rates.
They can't. They don't get the preferential borrowing rates that large companies do. B, they don't have the scale to be able to balance it all out. So if somebody's got one store or five stores, they can't make the money elsewhere that they're losing here. And they also don't have the ability to do anything about it. So they don't pass every last piece of that increase that they're feeling in interest rates or the cost of goods onto their consumers, which means small businesses have their profit margins squeezed during times of rising interest rates.
Yeah.
Corporations, on the other hand, are much more successful at passing that through to their consumers. You just simply pay a higher price for something, and the corporation doesn't get its profit margin squeezed. In fact, there's some evidence that some companies who are not even suffering because of higher interest rates, because they're not paying higher interest rates or because of inflation, are taking advantage of the idea that the consumer is expecting to pay more, so they're raising rates, and corporate profitability is actually increasing. So small business profitability is decreasing in this environment of raising interest rates, and large companies are making more money.
What's up with that? You know, corporate profits are at a record high this year. I mean, we're adjusting the interest rates, but is there anything that can be done about that potential abuse of the rate.
Not in a normal capitalist society, but there's no law against making as much money as you can make. It's not like price gouging in a hurricane where you charge more money for something that people desperately need. This is just companies charging more money for things that consumers are willing to pay for. And so far, consumers have been willing to keep on buying and paying for things. In fact, we saw Black Friday and Cyber Monday were record-breaking. However, as you and I speak, the stock market is down several percent today because suddenly, and this is the first time we got a retail sales report that suggests the consumer might be weakening. Now, we don't know whether that's because they don't want to pay higher interest on their credit card. We don't know whether that's because inflation is causing them to step back. But the one thing that we do know from every recession we've had in this country is that the American consumer is the canary in the coal mine when it comes to a recession. So the idea that just a little bit, the consumer retreated just a little bit in the last month has now got investors spooked into thinking that all this interest rate hike, all these raises are going to cause a recession.
Yeah, but this is the Goldilocks part in the minute we have, because this whole idea of raising the interest rates is to slow down the economy. It's too hot.
Yes.
So if it slows it down too much, you know, you get to, so tell us that just a little bit of that in the minute we have.
Yes, you're looking for mama bear here. You do not want to slow down the economy so much that there's a recession, but you need to slow it down enough that people ease up on their spending. There is no science to this whatsoever. It is all an art form. It's what the consumer thinks. Remember, recessions are not scientific. They're consumers who say, I'm worried that I'm not going to have a job next year, so I stop spending. So that's exactly where we are. If the consumer's slowing down a little bit right now, everything will be fine. If the consumer's slamming on the brakes suddenly, while we still have inflation, the Fed finds itself in a real pickle because they've got to get inflation down while the economy is slowing down. We're not there yet. I would not use a couple days as a trend, but we're in that worrisome part where it could be Goldilocks, could be something else.
And it's our job. Slow down a little, but not too much.
That's right.
Ali Velshi, right. MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent. Thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Another impact of those economic rumblings, companies are cutting internship programs. How that's going over with some young people after the break. This week, NPR canceled its internship program for next summer. It says to help weather a budget shortfall and avoid layoffs. And they're not alone. NPR internships are paid, but many are not, which is part of why Carlos Mark Vera started a group called Pay Our Interns. He spoke to Deepa Fernandez, and he said while he can sympathize with companies trying to find a way to avoid layoffs, the loss of early career opportunities hits some communities especially hard.
Latino and Black students are the least likely to have paid internships. And what ends up happening is they don't intern because they can't afford it, and once they graduate, they don't have experience in their fields, and they don't get hired. And we kind of create this glass ceiling for a lot of youth of color. And it ultimately reflects in our institutions, right? Like, they don't reflect our diverse communities. So this is a racial and economic justice issue.
Yeah, so holding that, let's take a broader view of what's going on with internships. Because when we last had you on the show right before the pandemic, you know, you'd been fighting for interns to not only get paid for their work, but to get paid a decent wage. So, you know, now the end of 2022, how would you describe the landscape for people seeking a paid internship?
I have to say, this has probably been one of the biggest years for interns.
That's good news.
And I say that specifically, you know, we first got Congress to pay their interns. And then we kind of said, okay, this is awesome, but let's keep on opening opportunities across the federal government. And we successfully secured $40 million in appropriations for White House internships and State Department internships. And we've started to really see this like ripple effect across sectors. So I'll give an example. The Met didn't pay their interns. They started their internship program this summer, paid one. They had 3,000 applications for 50 slots, a 200% increase. They're calling it a great success. The Humane Society. So you're now seeing more organizations offer paid opportunities. But I do want to preface, with an economic downturn, that's usually the first thing that gets cut. We saw this at the start of the pandemic. Most people lost their internships. And that led us to create a mutual aid fund called the Intern Opportunity Fund, because people needed money to pay rent, eat, so on and so forth. So that's really our biggest concern, is with things going, you know, kind of south, young people are going to be impacted, which creates economic scarring.
Yeah. You know, you connected us with a University of Michigan graduate student named Larissa Mednes, and she's fighting to have her school pay students $20 an hour to complete required internships. She's studying social work and also working as an unpaid intern at a community center. Her net income from a separate part-time job each month is about $400, and she's on food stamps, and she says many of her classmates are even worse off.
There's a national social worker shortage, and everyone likes to sit around scratching their heads wondering why. This is why. We shouldn't have to make so many sacrifices just because we decided to earn a degree that's designed to uphold the social safety net and better our communities and society.
Carlos, what I'm hearing from Larissa is something you've told us about in the past, about how students feel there's a need for universities to provide funding to pay them for their hours of working these internships. How common is this, and has there been a larger movement on that front?
We have started to see more schools offer stipends and grants for people to do unpaid internships. I think in her specific example, it's University of Michigan. It's a school that has a $17 billion endowment. They have the funds to pay their students, right? Because for students like her, not only is she not getting paid, she's paying her school thousands of dollars to work for free. It just doesn't make sense.
Carlos Marquevera is the co-founder and executive director of Pay Our Interns. Carlos, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
By the way, we've had interns from NPR go on to be full-time members of our staff on this show, and we're very grateful for all of them. They're fantastic. So here's hoping the program comes back soon. After the break, census surveys help determine where and how federal dollars get spent. We'll hear from somebody who says the government could better address systemic racism if it counted Americans descended from enslaved people. Stick around.
A growing number of racial justice advocates are calling for the 2030 census to include a box for American descendants of slavery. They say accurate data are critical for understanding income, education, and health disparities within the Black community. Last month, groups including the American Descendants of Slavery Advocacy Foundation, or ADOS, made their case to the White House. Let's bring in Yvette Carnell, president of the ADOS Advocacy Foundation. Welcome, Yvette.
Thank you for having me.
Yvette, tell us why it matters that we have an accurate count of how many descendants of slavery there are in the U.S.
Well, I think it matters first to understand how we got this wrong in the first place. The way we sort of count things now is like this sort of flat blackness, right? So everybody's black the same. But when you look at health outcomes, when you look at income disparities, when you look at where you are in terms of Boston, it's ADOS, American Descendants of Slavery are worth $8. You see black immigrants are worth like 1,800, right? That was the wealth study. So you can't understand the group unless you disaggregate the group because there are different health outcomes for the group. There are different incarceration rates for black immigrants as opposed to American descendants of slavery. So you have to take a microscope to the groups to see the impact of slavery on us that is not the impact that black immigrants have on a whole variety of levels.
So that's very powerful data that you're quoting there. And I'm wondering, because there aren't great records of descendants of slavery in the country, how can people find out if they are a descendant of someone who was enslaved?
Well, I think the American government has to help us with that, right? But you have to look at the fact that the number of black immigrants who were here pre-1965, pre-Immigration Act, was to the right of the decimal point. And so you had some Caribbeans who were here and largely with help from the UK. You had a few of those. But overwhelmingly, this was a Negro nation in terms of American descendants of slavery, white people, et cetera, et cetera. So if you can trace your lineage back to that time, if you can trace your lineage back to sharecropping, you know that 99 times out of 100, you're an American descendant of slavery.
And, you know, there are these more detailed breakdowns of the data that exists for other groups in the census, like Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans. What could change if we knew how many descendants of slavery there are?
Well, we would really understand the impact that slavery has had on us. When you go to 1990, that's when you see this skyrocketing number of Black immigrants come to this country. Like, if you go look at the Pew Research chart, it skyrockets and takes off at that point. And we don't even really understand, like, in terms of this group, when you talk about slavery, so much of our lives right now, our economic life, in terms of the fact that we're going over an economic cliff, is tied back to slavery and multi-generational oppression. Other groups don't have that same relationship with America, and they don't have those same outcomes. So if you take that away, I think you would see how what we've lived through, what we've gone through over generations in America has impacted us and basically robbed us of the Americanness that we deserve in this country.
And we know that census numbers really are used to target resources when we know certain populations are in certain places. I'm wondering if you can give us some examples. You know, say this all comes to be, and on the 2030 census there is a box, and we discover how many American descendants of slavery there are. What are some uses of resources that you think will benefit the community?
Well, one of the things we see, even in terms of housing, we're 50% in a lot of places renters. Black immigrants are much more likely to be homeowners. They're much less likely to be in prison. So even if you talk about housing and getting us into homeownership, right, that's a place where we could focus that on and say, see, we have a disparity here that isn't clear. It's not clear if you talk about us in just in terms of Black. It's not clear if you talk about it just in terms of people of color. This is a disparity. Right. And so what's happening is that you can't see our disparities, specifically in terms of us being ADOS, not Black, because there's nobody really thinks of themselves in terms of, even when you talk about socialization, nobody thinks of themselves as a Ghanaian American doesn't think of themselves as I'm just Black. They'll tell you, I didn't really understand this sort of American Blackness until I got here. But that's not how anybody is socialized. That's not how anybody lives. And so you can't see a disparity in that kind of context, because it really never made sense. And it certainly can't be used to identify these sort of dehumanizing disparities that can be traced all the way to slavery. So I think you take that away and you can unmask the fact that we are on the bottom and we're below people who just got here. Whether you just got here in 1965, your folks got here in 1965, or they got here in 1990, we fall below that. And you can tie that directly to slavery. And the only way you can see that is to disaggregate the data.
You know, I have to ask you, could it unintentionally divide the Black community in ways that you don't want?
Well, I don't think so. The truth is, we've already been divided. We've been divided a very long time in terms of the economic data, in terms of how we are being perceived by white people, in terms of our outcomes. So there are divisions that already exist in our lives. And the reason we call ourselves American descendants of slavery was Martin Luther King who said that first. So there are differences in who we are. We have no real tie to, if you've been in this country generations, we are not African in terms of how we view ourselves and our culture. So it's not divisive to say that this is who we are, this is what we've endured, and you have to count that. You have to make that matter. And if you talk to people, they'll tell you, listen, I don't, when I go home to my mother, I'm Nigerian, and we talk about Naja life. We talk about, you know, how to view life and how to do things in a Naja way, right? It's only when it comes to ADOS that people say, you all are not allowed to have any agency. You all are not allowed to describe yourselves and decide how you're going to be named and called. So when people say it's divisive, it's just very interesting that other groups have always been allowed to identify how they choose to identify, and they've been allowed to have that agency. It's only when it comes to us, people say, well, you shouldn't do that.
And ADOS, of course, is American Descendant of Slavery. Yvette Carnell, you make a very powerful case. She's the president of the ADOS Advocacy Foundation, talking to us about the movement to include American Descendants of Slavery on the 2030 census. Thank you, Yvette.
Thank you.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. As always, there's more to read and listen to on hereandnow.org. Today, we've got a conversation with the mayor-elect of Oakland, California. Sheng Tao is the city's first Hmong American mayor.
Many of the elders did not think that they would be alive to see this day, including my mother.
Today's stories were produced by James Mastromarino, Ashley Locke, and Sam Rafelson. Gabe Bullard and Peter O'Dowd edited the show. Technical direction from Max Liebman and Mike Garth. Theme music by me, Max, and Mike Moschetto. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.